your best love films, the podcast that goes with bestlovefilms.com. Let's begin by acknowledging that this land, the United States of America, was stewarded beautifully by hundreds of generations of Native Americans long before any white people showed up. We want to thank them for that. We also want to try to renew our commitment to making this a better place together. Okay, my name is Daniel Smith Rousey. I'm a PhD, also author of three books about film. I've made a few films, you know, they're on YouTube. Okay. Everybody's a filmmaker now, but I feel like what I had to do for those is, I don't know, a little more. You look at them and tell me if you think I'm right. Okay. The topic today, thank you for joining us for another exciting edition of the E-List, the experimental list. We're going over films. If you've gotten this far, you know what we're doing here. These are the avant-garde 100, kind of the first 100 avant-garde films you should know. Certainly not the only 100. There's lots more to learn after these, but you know, this is a reasonable introduction to the world of experimental film. Okay, so today's five films, E81 through E85 on this list. So well, we're getting to the end, aren't we? I mean, after this, it'll only be 15 more to go. Wow. Okay, they are, and you know, I need to talk a little bit about that, how we sort of favor the 20th century. I'm saving that. That's a big reveal for the final episode. Okay, but today's five films, let's get to that. They are Super Dyke, Crossroads, Riddles of the Sphinx. Yes, it's Riddles of the Sphinx. Powers of 10. Not everybody puts that on this list. And Technology Transformation, Wonder Woman. Okay. Fascinating films for many different reasons. Well worth your time. Okay. So let's go to start with Super Dyke. You know, there are definitely people who would start with Dyke Tactics. So why Super Dyke instead? You know, either one's good. Who was Barbara Hammer? Who is Barbara Hammer? Well, sadly, we've lost her. She was another, you know, person who came to a film school, in this case, San Francisco State University. She came in the 70s. She said she was inspired when she saw Maya Deren's Meshes of the Afternoon. Obviously, we've spoken about that. That's one of the highlights of this list. She wanted to make more experimental films about her personal life. Thank God for that. And that's great. I love Dyke Tactics. It's also short. It's only 4 minutes, which was great. It was a breakthrough. Barbara Hammer's website, I've got it right here, barbarahammer.com. Thank God somebody's keeping this thing up, even after we've lost Hammer herself. Just looking at it, it says that it's widely considered to be one of the first lesbian films. Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's not that it's not true. It's just that there had definitely been films focused on gay women, maybe not made by gay women, not enough. Okay. I love this thing. I'm just going to read it straight from her website. Presumably she authorized this sentence. Hammer sought to deconstruct and disempower the narratives and structures that oppress women in general and lesbians in particular. How about one more sentence? From her earliest experimental work, her films are playfully and relentlessly challenging of accepted norms and taboos. Great. Okay. And you know, Super Dyke, what's fun about it is that it's like, it just gets right going immediately. It's just jumping onto the streets, really. And I love that she, you know, paid for these tank tops for everybody. Okay. I feel like Super Dyke is sort of a clearer articulation of everything. That's one of the reasons I like it a little better than Dyke Tactics. I like that it's longer. I like that it's like 15, 20 minutes instead of just 4 minutes. Okay. But you know, your mileage may vary. Okay. So let's, explain or let's summarize Super Dyke. Okay. It begins with women springing out of houses in San Francisco holding signs that are really more like shields or badges that say Amazon. The music is almost always jaunty piano. All these women wear yellow tank tops that say Super Dyke on them if you read. Although most of the women wearing them have some kind of shirt on under that. They march through San Francisco proudly bearing their shields. They board a school bus emblazoned with a banner that reads Lesbian Express. One woman in a crutch falls before the bus, perhaps to stop it. But as they go to help her, as the women go, this fallen woman reveals her super dyke tank top, and everyone smiles. The bus rolls along. Some women passengers in it read, six women stand in a line on the steps of San Francisco City Hall and bear their Amazon shields. In fluid handheld shots, they dance around in the square next to City Hall. Women ride motorcycles, some with two on one bike, to the beach. At the beach, they frolic with their clothes on in the scene. After a title saying Amazon Playground, we see the tank top women in the park lifting their fists and cheering. In the film's eighth minute, some women begin to kiss each other. Okay, so Barbara Hammer set you up for 7 minutes, gotten you used to that. And remember, it's the 70s, and some people are not used to that sight yet. Anyway, in the ninth minute, in a museum, we see paintings of naked women and paintings of women kissing, establishing this is, you know, long ago art form. Okay, at Macy's, San Francisco, in very sped up time lapse, a woman wearing a t-shirt reading Dyke over a Superman logo shows some of the many uses of a vibrator. At a park's statue, the camera zooms into many faces wearing helmets as though preparing for battle. Women wearing helmets and the super dyke tank tops move forwards healthily, bearing, they look healthy. They're bearing large bows, you know, like the Amazons of legend. But these Amazons, when they finish doing a bit of that, they huddle and they cuddle, dropping their bows and falling into a mutual embrace on the grass. The next bit is set in interiors where women massage other women's faces and shoulders in a relatively chaste manner. In the 14th minute of this film, a card reads, in the country, as we are somewhere that looks like rural Marin County. We're familiar with that already from this list. Inside and outside a teepee, women are stark naked, including at least two preteen girls. The women play with old dry animal bones, twisting them in the air in what seems like a ritual. A woman leads them out of the teepee. They walk in a line naked. The final montage sums up the images that we've already seen, favoring a lot of those lesbian express sections. Okay, and that's it. That's the film. I think it's important, this as an intervention. I think it kind of makes a nice contrast to The Bed, which I'm sure Hammer had to be aware of. How could you not be aware of it? It was kind of this sensation in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, The Bed is cool for what it is. But I think this is sort of a nice kind of sort of pivot of a lot of that to something different, you know, with the use of Marin County, San Francisco. Anyway, Hammer, you know, I don't have to say how big a deal Barbara Hammer is. I mean, it's funny, like you know, she's considered this great avant-garde artist, and so she should be. I mean, it's not like I don't have to sell her because she's sort of known. She's definitely somebody you come across. We'll come back to her too, because I think her first feature is also deserves a place on this list too. So we're going to get back to that. So, you know, we will revisit the great work of Barbara Hammer. We're not done with her on this list yet, but thank you, Barbara Hammer, for all your great work. Now we are going to move on to the next person, Bruce Conner. Again, when I introduced Bruce Conner the first time, I mean, you know, maybe it's my thing. I mean, I like his work. I just feel like he's just a notch overrated. I mean, he's fine. I really shouldn't. I don't know what my issue is. I mean, he's good. It feels like people know him and then they don't know anybody else except maybe Andy Warhol. It's like, okay, yeah, Conner's cool, but like learn something else. I don't know. I mean, a movie, like, I don't know what it is. I feel like, I mean, this is based on my limited experience, but I feel like people know a movie, you know, and then they don't know anything else. I don't know. Or whatever. I mean, but you know what? Bruce Conner's fine. He is good. In the case of this film, which was kind of a big thing in the world of avant-garde film, he used a bunch of footage of the basically of the test of a nuclear bomb at Bikini Atoll on July 25th, 1946. Yes, all this footage is from the exact same day. In fact, pretty much the exact same hour, which is already its own kind of avant-garde statement. You haven't really seen that many 30-minute plus films in your life, which were all filmed within the same hour. Yeah, you might have seen one or two before this one. But it is its own comment just for that. If nothing else, that's something. Yeah, I mean, he named the film Crossroads. It's an interesting choice of a name. It works. Clearly, the name of the operation was Operation Crossroads, and they did film it from a lot of angles. But it's so I don't think he faked any of this footage. I don't think so. I'm not actually not 100% sure of that. He did, change the audio sometimes. Well, of course. I mean, how what filmmaker is not gonna, take some liberties with the audio? Unless it's Stan Brakhage who's choosing not to have any audio at all, that's different. But I mean, assuming your movie has audio, of course they're gonna try sweetening it. And yeah, some people mentioned that, like in retrospect, that like, well, okay, the bomb blast wouldn't have been heard from that angle, or not yet. You need there's needs to be it's depending on the shot. Some of them are like, kind of like how thunder and lightning aren't synced, and so people are like, well, you messed with the sync. It's like, you know what? So what? I mean, he's doing what he's doing. It is an avant-garde film. You can tell that by the feeling of it. Okay, let's describe the film. I mean, certainly the dawn of the atomic age, which, arguably began a year earlier with Hiroshima, but still, this is still kind of important. You could argue, that was a wartime expediency. This isn't. Okay, so what do you see? I'm kind of detailed. I'm kind of like scared of myself that I've like kind of gotten into the weeds here. Okay, Crossroads begins with a crosshairs, followed by a title card, Bikini Atoll, July 25, 1946. Okay. For about a minute, we are in a shoreline seeing nothing. Then, off center to the left, the explosion that becomes a mushroom cloud in slow-mo, as most of the shots in the film are done. You get a lot of slow-mo here. A second version is from the air, where the sky is dotted with several little cumulus clouds, almost like God was setting a pattern. After another minute or so, the explosion again, with mushroom cloud building and crescendoing. As it goes, we actually do see it billow from other slightly lower angles. Deadly smoke fills up the frame. The third version starts out at sea, and sure enough, this explosion begins much more in our face, continuing pushing smoke all around the frame's edges. From this and similar angles, the moment of the explosion repeats a few times. The screen goes black for a while. On the return, we are much farther up in the sky, so that when the explosion starts, it only takes up a small part of the middle of the frame. Yet we see its shockwaves roll through the nearby ocean. The next few shots come in closer to repeat the explosion in a way that its smoke takes up most of the frame. Editing almost makes one think that we have panned off of the smoke into a deserted part of the ocean, but then the explosion happens again, lingering that we might see the reef behind it. A pan down and cut, and we return to a blinking strobe continuation of where we had been, with the one vertical leftover cloud surrounded by a massive donut-shaped radioactive cloud vibrating over the ocean. The music becomes steadily more Philip Glass-like, although it's actually by Patrick Gleason, after more shots with more expressive cloud tendrils coming from the explosion. It's really about how expressive those can be. A couple of clouds look like they're lingering over many nearby battleships. Cut to a very wide shot of at least a dozen battleships, and then in the midst of them, the explosion again, raining smoke and destruction on them. As the smoke clears, we get no battleships either, just empty water. Very gradually, a silhouette of a ship, or perhaps a ship, enters our frame along the waterline, fade to black. I like that ending, actually. I think that's one of the best things about that he did, is that he kind of found an ending, and an enigmatic one at that. Okay, what is about Crossroads? Yeah, I mean, it's in the Academy of Film Archive. It comes up a lot. Manola Dargis wrote an article about it in the New York Times. I mean, many years later, it's kind of a profound experience. It's a good reminder of the kind of unprecedented nature of our times. I'm glad he made this for this what at the time was the 30-year anniversary of it, of the event. It's weird how many anniversaries have now passed in the years since. It's still important. I think it's still there's something vital about this film. I like that it's calling our attention to explosions, if you will. It was a bit of an explosive era, wasn't it? I mean, that's just it, is like, I think that in the 70s, and we're going to see that again with the Wonder Woman film, they was like, what are these explosions that, it was a time when action movies were becoming a thing. You know, we were so blasé about such things in the old days. You know, the westerns were considered action movies in the 50s. You know, John Wayne got on a horse, and suddenly that was enough, apparently, for a whole generation of like, hey, that's hard-hitting action. Well, that wasn't enough by the 70s. We needed explosions, and it feels like they're commenting on, I feel these filmmakers are kind of commenting on that. So that's part of this. Just the comment on the sort of, you know, what is Crossroads saying? I mean, I don't know that we know. I think it's a bit of a let's look at our sort of love for destruction. I think. I mean, I you know, and it, kind of breaking it down. What is it? Deconstructing it. I don't know if I understand the full deconstruction. I'm not even claiming I do, but I'm just saying I think it's valuable to kind of just make it strange, if you will, you know, sort of set it off, make it strange. Okay. Great. All right. Well, I've covered that now, I think, a little. I mean, you know, you probably, some people are going to listen to this and they love Bruce Conner. They can't wait. What else do I have to say about Bruce Conner? Well, sorry. Sorry, I'm not a bigger fan. I don't know. It's fine. His stuff's good. Okay. Let's move on to film E83, Riddles of the Sphinx. This is quite a film, I think. It's really cool in many ways. It's not a short film, unlike the last two I just said. Well, no, but it's not that long. It's just a 90-minute film, just standard. Now, this could have been on a list of, you know, other kinds of films, but I think it does fit into the experimental canon, at least for me. Who is Laura Mulvey? Well, a lot of you would have heard, I think if you're already listening to this podcast, you probably heard of her. Not only that, you probably read her in college. Famous for her essay Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema, where she basically showed that the male gaze, so basically she kind of coined that term, and now we're still using it in the mainstream even, which is great. Questioning kind of how Hollywood sets up women to be looked at. She used the phrase to be looked at in this. I mean, there's a lot more to that. Her sort of deconstruction of scopophilia. The way that, you know, women are sort of set up. Now, it's interesting to me about this film. So she made this film with her, I want to say husband at the time, but I think they were married anyway, whatever it is, Peter Wallin. He was his own sort of big time film scholar. He had made this book in 69, Signs and Meanings in the Cinema. And that was a big deal because it sort of brought in the language of semiotics and other Saussurean things to, Saussurean sort of analysis to film studies. And that was big. I mean, basically he kind of opened up this world that really, this territory that a lot of other people then planted flags on in the 70s. And I think, so Wallin and Mulvey collaborating on this movie is already kind of a big deal for film studies. At least I mean, that might seem like a, you know, nothing if you're outside film studies, but that was cool. But the film holds up by itself. It doesn't need their pre-existing reputations. Even if you didn't know who they were, this would be a very interesting film. You do actually see Laura Mulvey in the film. She puts herself in it. She's talking. Should I get to why this film is cool, or should I summarize it first? One thing that gets me about the influence is that, like, so maybe some of you are listening to this and know that the film called Gene Dielman, you know, 23 Bruxelles, what am I'm getting the name wrong. You know the film I mean, Gene Dielman, you know, the film by Chantal Ackerman. So that came out in 75 at Cannes. I'm not sure that Mulvey had seen it before she was making this. And if she didn't, it's quite something that she sort of seems in harmony with where Ackerman is going. Maybe she did see it. I don't know. Although it seems unlikely because they were making this in 76. It only came out the film, but I mean, would she have been, maybe she had seen it. The Ackerman's film only came out. And now we're now looking at Sight and Sound has called Gene Dielman the greatest film of all time. Well, Ackerman died before she got that particular recognition. She probably wouldn't have minded it in any event. What I'm getting at is that, interestingly, both Ackerman and Mulvey were trying to establish this new kind of feminist language, and that was a difficult thing to do at the time because it was like, how can we use the language? I mean, there's cinema and it already has its pre-existing language, and how can we do cinema in a new way that would somehow be more feminist. And that was tricky. And in Ackerman's case, you have these very, very long takes, which seem to kind of honor women's work, the simple domestic labor of being a woman to some degree. I mean, I think that's a big part of what Jean Dielman is about. How could it not be at these very long takes? Well, meanwhile, Mulvey's doing a very similar thing, although instead of the long takes, the ones in Ackerman's film are steady. The ones in Mulvey and Wallen's film are, you know, these 360-degree pans. But I think they're both looking for that new language that is kind of like saying, maybe if we just simplify and just look at what, you know, normal women are doing, that counts, you know. And that's something that films have kind of not been doing, you know. And that, you know, women in films, well, in the 70s, there were in, at least in Hollywood, they were barely in films, or if they were, they were treated terribly. Usually, yes, there are exceptions. I happen to know them, like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, or, well, whatever. I mean, there are exceptions, but generally it wasn't a great time to be a woman on film in America in the 70s. Now, in Britain, it was a little different. In Brussels, it was a little different. Maybe, kind of, sort of. Never a great time. I mean, you know. Okay, now that I feel like now that I've, I mean, I just think that's really interesting to me that they were working on the same thing at the same time. I think it was, I mean, both Mulvey's essay was obviously this sort of ground-shaking intervention, which we're still, which I think anybody who takes film seriously is still living with. But then she also made this film, which is trying to explore some of the same things. I don't know that she got to everything. Let's see what she got to. Okay. Riddles of the Sphinx begins with a title card of a Gertrude Stein quote, quote, a narrative of what wishes what it wishes to be, unquote. Yes, I did not get that wrong. Over a close-up of a book's pages being turned. The final visible page of this book is of Greta Garbo's face superimposed on one of the pyramids of Giza. Or excuse me, it's actually with this over the Sphinx of Giza with the title Sphinx Moderne. In part two, Laura Mulvey appears as herself at her desk, sometimes talking over hieroglyphs and pre-modern paintings, explaining that their mother-child story needed a sphinx because it asks questions. Quote, motherhood as mystery and resistance to patriarchy, unquote. Mulvey invokes Oedipus to show how the sphinx scrambles categories of gender, animal, and even bird, thus challenging patriarchal constructions. Part three begins with mystical murmur music over slow-mo blurry pans of modern Giza. The camera flashes and pulses and doubles and closes up on the Sphinx's mouth. Part four begins with a title card asking if Louise is too close to her child and not dealing with others. In a slow waist-level 360-degree pan from left to right, we see Louise's modern English kitchen, eventually including her toddler in a high chair. A woman's voice names typical female concerns, but abstractly. After a card about sorting the end of the day, the camera does another slow waist-level 360-degree pan around the daughter's room as the woman's voice speaks, mostly in single words about issues. After a card about Chris leaving, we see a third such long pan, mostly of transitional spaces, as a man packs up a car to go, even speaking at the end that there's nothing more to say. After a fourth card about comfort with Maxine, the fourth long waist level pan is of a preschool or daycare center. The fifth such pan is of a telephone switchboard station, a classic place known for women's work, if you will. The sixth such pan is of a cafeteria, whereby the camera is far enough back to make full shots of many of its subjects, who are almost all female. After a seventh card cites union work on daycare, we hear women chatting about unions, doing little about daycare, as the seventh pan outside shows a traffic circle. An eighth pan at night shows a mall or shopping center. A ninth pan during the day outside shows a park with kids, play structures, as a woman's voice asks crucial questions for female and really all labor organizers. The 10th pan begins with an older woman bringing a toddler to, as she says, play in the garden, and indeed the pan focuses on said garden. The 11th card mentions Chris at work on a film preceding the 11th pan, which, unlike the first 10, goes from right to left, starting on white and revealing an editing bay, where Louise and Chris discuss what Louise needs, as well as discussing Chris's film. During this pan, lights go out as the screening begins, thus showing mostly blackness with occasional video as the female narrator of the video within this video explains her anxieties about work, patriarchal psychological syndromes. The 12th pan, also from right to left, is of a backstage room with deep red velvet curtains and theatrical props where women chat about some bad stories. The 13th pan is right to left, in the Egyptian Museum, as the narrator describes a woman's feelings about childhood and bodily limits. The narrator says the woman hears from a box a familiar sphinx's voice that causes her to smile and fling herself through the air. You don't see this, but that's what the narrator says. Okay, part five, finally, offers the first non-pan shots in about an hour, which are abstractified shots of circus performers practicing things like juggling and trapeze. And then we go back to Laura Mulvey at her desk, listening to recordings of her voice and another female voice describing anomie, I would say, in a word. Part seven is a close-up of a 3D maze puzzle, the kind that you can hold in your hand, with congealed drops of something like liquid gold being manipulated to the center as the second drop joins the first one, the film ends. Okay. I love this film. I mean, it's like, it's weird. It should be. I think it makes a great companion piece to Gene Dielman if you're checking out that now recently because you heard that there was a thing about, it being the number one film in Sight and Sound. No, I think this Riddles of the Sphinx, you know, it intentionally asks more questions than it answers. That's its whole point. That's the intervention. They say that right off the bat. And, you know, that it doesn't waver from that. But I think it brings up a lot of really interesting issues. I mean, yeah, this is well worth your time. I don't know what else to say other than that. I mean, I think it's a great deconstruction of filmic technique. They tried something that hadn't really been tried in experimental film, not really with these long pans and, you know, what they eventually mean. What do they mean? I'm not sure, but the movie knows that you don't necessarily know what they mean. It's good that way, you know. Okay, let's move on to E84, Powers of 10. Well, how do I introduce Charles and Ray Eames, the married couple? Well, they're kind of awesome, aren't they? This is a very different married couple. This is other than Peter Fullen and Bill and Laura Mulvey. Who were they? They were these great designers, really. I mean, these chairs that you may have sat in came from them. Go ahead and look at the Eames house. They were basically architects, organic chairs. They in many ways they created the modern aesthetic. They're really fascinating to look up. If you haven't heard of them, then once you look at them, you're going to be like, wow. You may have seen their work gets exhibited a lot. It's great. They're really interesting, the way that the furniture design that they did. I don't know. I find the Eames, I could get into the Eames for forever. They're quite fascinating. By the time they made this film, it was interesting. They'd already made a movie called Powers of Ten. They actually made two of them, but the one that is better known is the one we're talking about today. They made a first one trying to adapt this book called Cosmic View by Kes Bwecki. But by the time they were, so that book actually came out in the 50s. Their first attempt was like 10 years later. And we knew a little bit more about the cosmos, that let's hope so. And then even 10 years after, we knew even more. And they had just a slightly bigger budget and some money from IBM. It was designed as an instructional film so that they knew just a little bit more. So now it's 20 years after Kes Bwecki's initial book. And it's sort of, I think that some of the choices in this film really border on the avant-garde anyway. I mean, so why is this film here? That's a reasonable question. Well, Is Powers of 10 a documentary? Is it strictly, I mean, yes and no. It's so weird that it kind of doesn't qualify as a documentary. I mean, it is, but there's so much that is faked that I mean, at least at this time, nowadays, thanks to Errol Morris, as we described in when we talked about the D-list, we're so used to reenactments, but we weren't then, and so therefore it barely qualified as a documentary. Is it an instructional film? Yeah. But it's not even really that. I mean, it is and it isn't. Is it science fiction? In many ways, it is all and none of these. Not unlike Zorn's Lemma, it only feels like a lesson from one kind of perspective. Like that film, it is made with nuance and fluidity. That's the thing. It's the nuance and it's the way it's narrated that is like takes it out of the realm of the simple instructional film. Powers of 10 basically belongs on the experimental list, I think, both because it scrambles all these genre categories and also takes the power of the zoom further than any film, arguably to its logical conclusions. There is no better. I mean, if we just explored the power of the pan with Wallen and Mulvey's film, which was awesome, now we explore the power of the zoom. And I don't think you're going to explore it any more than this film does. I mean, that's something that's worth 1 in 100, I think. After you've seen Powers of 10, the beginning seems more interesting. Title cards about distance and adding a zero over a blurry shot of food that eventually yields to traditional medium shots of two people preparing a picnic. I love also that I don't think these are two the I don't think they're both white people, which is cool for the 70s, you know. On repeat, I mean, these Eames were cool for what who they were, right? On repeat, when you've seen this like several times, as I have, you somehow have the effect of producing the way it begins with kind of traditional normal shots actually has the effect of producing relief when the camera cuts to a bird's eye view exactly above the two people settling on the picnic blanket. That feeling of relief fascinates me on the third or fourth viewer because you could, if they had just started with this initial shot, which is really the entire film, I could see how that wouldn't feel the same way. So I think that was clever and very film-like, very artist-like, very uninstructional. The music too, it's like a calliope at first. Okay, anyway. Plus just this choice of narrator. They'd had a different narrator in the 60s version of this. This narrator's affect seems to almost twinkle like a star or like a beloved Santa type. Anyway, this narrator, I have his name lying around here, Philip Morrison. All right, Morrison. Anyway, he tells us we're on Chicago's lakeside on a lazy afternoon one October. See, the initial movie was Miami. I think it was smart for them to set us right in the middle of America, you know, kind of, if that's one way of looking at Chicago. The camera's initial rise is almost jerky, which I also find very fascinating. It didn't need to be. See, that is another thing that kind of sets you into, well, what are these people doing? And I love that because it's like once you find out what they're doing, wow. Of course, it does have to settle into a smooth motion. The frame of the image is an exact square, but on the square's sides, we see measurements. Left in meters expressed as a whole number, on the right in meters expressed as 10 to the x power. X will keep changing as the movie changes. Morrison says, quote, every 10 seconds we will look from 10 times farther away and our view will be 10 times wider, unquote. And by the way, this is the kind of movie that does exactly what it says it's going to do. Little diaphanous squares come off the edge and shrink into the center. The narrator offers colorful commentary on distance, for example, how far a man can run in 10 seconds or how far a supersonic jet can travel in 10 seconds. Music is spacey, even scary at some points. At 10 to the 16th power meters, or 1 light year, he notes we still haven't come to the nearest star to our sun. At 10 to the 20th meters, he notes, as we see, that our chosen exit point of Chicago has brought us perpendicular to the Milky Way's great spiral. At 10 to the 24th, the zoom finally stops at the quote, edge of our current vision, unquote. A mostly inky view whose loneliness the narrator contrasts with the exceptional abundance of our own region of the universe. The largest zoom in his cinematic history begins right then. The direct way back to Earth changes powers of 10 every 2 seconds, 5 times faster than the voyage out. Well before we return to our solar system, the narrator signposts the final goal, a proton within a picnicker's hand. The narrator's countdown is like a mirror of the space race, a twisted inverted mirror, maybe 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then 10 to the zero, which is 1 meter, which is where the zoom slows, and quote, "Now we reduce the distance to our final destination by 90%, each step much smaller than the one before," unquote. He walks us through the skin, the capillaries, the DNA, the double helixes. The left side measures in angstroms. At 1 angstrom, the right side is at 10 to the negative 10. We pass through fuzzy electron clusters into a carbon nucleus made of 6 protons and 6 neutrons. And this is where he, smartly kind of ties it into what we started the movie with. He says, quote, "There are atoms bonded to every molecule out to the farthest galaxy," unquote. At 10 to the negative 14, the narrator says, quote, "As a single proton fills our scene, we reach the edge of present understanding," unquote. The full journey has gone through 40 powers of 10. All right, that's it. I guess I've already pretty much said why I think this belongs. I mean, yeah, I'm not leaving myself a lot to be discussed in the after summary, and that's okay. I don't have to leave myself that. Yeah, this is quite a film. I mean, I know why it got adopted into the National Film Registry and everywhere else. It's something. I mean, it's weird. It somehow touches beyond. Yes, it is an instructional film, but the way it's narrated, the way it's kind of cleverly done, the metaphors somehow touch something sort of unexpected. And I think that there's something about this film. Yes, I guess you can compare it a little bit to Zorn's Lemma, but what's great, again, it's kind of like the Eames didn't even really try to do this, but they did. They show an artist's perspective. Okay, and now for the final film. This is by Dara, final film of today's podcast, Dara Birnbaum. She had went to Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. She worked in an architectural firm, much like Eames. Then she got a BFA in painting from the San Francisco Art Institute. Worked with other video artists, and at some point, she started making experimental video works such as control piece and mirroring. So then I mean, basically, she worked on a bunch of different things. She's still alive. You want to go text or send a tweet to her, tell her how much you appreciate her work. Go right ahead. Anyway, she you could argue she was also working in a sort of a feminist he. When she made Technology Transformation Wonder Woman. You know what? In this case, why don't I summarize the film and then I'll say what I think it's cool about it. Okay, so this is a shorter film than any of the other ones that we've been talking about, even shorter than Powers of 10, which is like 9 minutes. This is only like 5.5. This film begins with a lot of audible explosions supplemented by siren noises, with moving flame utterly filling the frame. Yes, I said that right. We see the actress Linda Carter playing civilian Diana Prince in a pantsuit, holding a purse, which I think is interesting, arms outstretched, spinning 6 times, each time generating a fireball or explosion that starts in her torso and comes to encompass the frame. After the sixth spin, she becomes Wonder Woman and runs out of frame with the urgency of a hero called to action. As she runs through a wooded glade, she comes into a medium shot that is freeze-framed 4 times. Cut to Wonder Woman in the same glade, spinning, generating that fireball. Then the film oddly cuts to Wonder Woman spinning in a carnival hall of mirrors, one of which she approaches and moves her hand across as though confronting her own image. Huh. In the same place, now cut, Diana Prince spins fireballs and becomes Wonder Woman, who spins fireballs and becomes Diana Prince, who spins fireballs and becomes Wonder Woman. A car seat-sized patch of cardboard appears on the mirror, and Wonder Woman pushes through it, entering a room where a sort of disheveled civilian man comes in through another door. She tells him, "We've got to stop meeting like this, come on," and escorts him out a third door. The film cuts to a parking garage where that same man hides behind a concrete column while Wonder Woman deflects bullets that are shot at both of them with her wristbands. cut to Wonder Woman, excuse me, running in a yellow field. The camera cuts from medium shot to close up, a sequence done three times. Back in that glade, Wonder Woman spins and fireballs with so many repetitions as to seem like a punished rag doll. Return to the explosions at the start. The screen turns blue as the song Wonder Woman Disco begins. The song's lyrics are scrolled on video. And that's about it. Yeah. I do, you know, I don't always recommend a wiki, as you well know. I thought the one for this movie is kind of interesting because they clearly cut and pasted some sort of interesting, you know, the reason that the film is deconstructive. For example, I could just read this. The representation of repeated transformations expose the illusion of fixed female identities in media and attempt to show the emergence of a new woman through the use of technology. It mirrors and restages television's technical procedures. Yes. I think that's all true. You know, this wiki says it's noted for its potential criticism of television and its modalities. Yes, I think all of that is true. I think in many ways, I mean, it's also trying to deal with, you know, what is this kind of Venus figure now as a superhero, as an explosion? You know, I mean, we've had these, obviously, you know, painters, artists have been working with these idealized women, you know, young women forever. I mean, we've had Venus, we've had all kinds of Peter Paul Rubens paintings. We've had all kinds of women. And now here we are in the 70s, and it's this thing with, you know, I do think that, you know, there's a questioning of what is this? What, you know, a little bit like Crossroads to me, it's saying what, you know, you can argue that, well, okay, it's nothing without Linda Carter's beauty carrying the day. Right. I get that. That's not untrue. But also, what is it? What are we? What is so good about this to us? Is it because she's in this America star-spangled costume? Yeah, what are we kind of expecting and asking for? What is that? You know, if this is feminism in the 70s, whence feminism? Where's it going? You know, I think in just a few minutes, Dara Birnbaum asks a lot of very useful questions. We can talk more about this, but I think, yeah, it's a very useful film. Okay. I keep changing up. Once I watch the films that we're going to see for the next week, I realize that I actually want to change them up. So I'm not even sure I should signpost next week's episode. But these are a lot of fun and valuable. We will get into the 80s next week, and that will be fun. One way or the other, we're getting there. We will be moving gently down the stream to the 80s. That's a little signpost of its own. So that's all I'm going to say so far. But in any event, I hope you'll join me. Till then, save me some popcorn, because there's always another movie to see.